Welcome to Cut the Bull, an insightful podcast which addresses the news of the day and the cultural issues plaguing our society, bringing logic and context to these topics and discussing solutions too real for mainstream pundits. Now, here are your hosts, Charles Love and Wilfred Riley.
Hello and welcome to Cut the Bull. I am Charles Love, alongside my co-host Wilfred Riley, and our guest this week is Larissa Phillips. She is the founder and, what are you, director of the Volunteer Education Project, a literacy project. And that is really important work. I hope to get to that, and if not, to have you back to talk about that. But we met fortuitously, and I thought it'd be great to have you on to talk about a recent piece you wrote for Quillette that kind of went viral. The article is entitled "Toward Ruin or Recovery: The Modern Feminist Response to Rape is Failing Women, and It is Failing Victims of Rape Most of All." Larissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm totally thrilled to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. I read this piece before meeting you, and then, like I said, we just happened to meet, and I thought that that would be a great thing to talk about, because one of the people that, you know, we do these things at the end of the year sometimes, and we talk about the past shows and the great conversations, and every once in a while we'll say, who do you want to have on you haven't had on? And I think I sent you the book. One of the people that I haven't had on yet was Casey Johnson, because he used to talk about how rape was being handled in college. And this was, 7 years ago or something. So this kind of made me think of that when I read it, because I want to talk about why you wrote it, but you were responding to another article, right? So you told something you've never written before, but you felt compelled to write this after reading that. And why is that the case?
Well, the article was, it was in the journal Liberties, and it was written by a writer named Celeste Marcus. And it was called After Rape, A Guide for the Tormented. And it was a very long piece about a rape that the writer had suffered, she alleged, and a lot about the trauma that goes on around rape. And it was 2.5 years later, and she was still very much like kind of deep in this unrequited trauma. And she never really described the rape that much. Like it left it very, there were a lot of holes. There was more questions left than answered. And that would have been fine. Okay, so she wrote this article. And then she named the rapist on Twitter a few days later, and then went to the Atlantic Monthly, where he was a writer, and asked that he, you know, that they do something. And they did. They severed ties with him. So no trial, no hearing, no evidence, no police report, nothing. And who knows? I don't know. Maybe the rape happened. Maybe it didn't. I have no idea. No one has any idea, because there's no evidence. And the whole idea for me, one of the things that was motivating for me to respond to this essay was just the lack of due process around rape, which has been happening for a long time. I mean, I first saw it happen when I was in college in 91, and a boy was kicked off campus for rape. And I was like, did he have a trial? Like, was there a hearing? And there's nothing. He was just kicked off campus. And I thought that was so weird. And I thought it was weird that no one else thought it was weird. It was just like, yeah, it's great. And then since then, it's just, you know, it's just continued on. It's pretty common now.
This just made me laugh, because you were like, they were like, did he have a trial? Did this? You say, that's just bad. They were like, yeah, it's, he got kicked off. It's great.
Yeah. Problem solved. You know, and the thing that's really crazy about that too is like, because now it's pretty standard, you know, a rape accusation comes and usually the boy has to leave. And the colleges really were pretending that they really think this is a predator, and that, so they're just like, go to another college, done. All you have to do is to make it go away is leave the college.
Right,
and
you made that great point.
Catholic church level stuff, yeah.
Yes, you know, that's a great point. It's like nothing's in the record or anything. They just push the guy away and nothing happens.
He lost his place in the school and he lost a scholarship maybe. And his name is stained, you know, people find out. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I think it's really, it's an insult to real rape victims, you know, because it's a serious crime. Like, it's a real serious crime. It's a real social problem that society has lived with forever. And to turn it into this sort of homegrown kind of, you know, DIY, like social media thing is insane, you know, because then it happens on social media too, that people will make accusations on social media. And it's just crazy. And it is insulting to real crime victims.
Right. Will, before we get to the her piece and what she tried to break down, and then obviously the very detailed way she described both this situation, but obviously, comparing that to what actually happened to her, which obviously got a lot of response. I do want to say a little bit about the person who wrote the article. Now you all can decide. We can say who it was since it was all over Twitter. But I went to read it because I said I should probably read what she was referencing. It was like behind a paywall. So I was like, do I want to get it? Because it's really long. Hers is already like 9,000 words. Do I want to write a book to get it? But it well, I looked out because it was one of those things like kind of like a lot of the articles online that you have to pay. You get a little snippet before, and to get the rest, you have to pay. And I'm gonna read something because it was in the snippet. And it let me know all I needed to know. I didn't need to read anymore. So this is the woman who wrote After a Rape, A Guide for the Tormented. And she's talking about rape, this stuff, and what it's like and what you deal with. And she says, the first months after my rape, I would play macabre mind games with myself whenever I was left alone. I would, for example, ask myself at regular intervals, what punishment would be bad enough? Sometimes I would deliberately pose the question at a time of relative peace to punish myself for allowing the memory of the evil to fade from the forefront of my attention. What punishment would be bad enough? What punishment would be bad enough? After 2 months out, I was able to make droll, dark quips about my little game with close friends. I would say that I wished I believed in hell, so that I could believe he would burn forever. And I would add that faith in the possibility of the eternal damnation is wasted on people who already have the comfort of a God. So I felt that lead into the piece gave me enough not to really need to read the rest to know what was going on. What are your thoughts, Will?
Well, I mean, that's quite an intro. I mean, you move there into like kind of the nature of evil in the metaphysical sense and all that. I mean, I think that this is a tough topic to some extent, especially to talk about as a guy and a fairly normal one. I looked at some of these articles as well when you talked about the theme of the show. I mean, so I would say two things that are very broad, and then I want to hear what the guest has to say a little more about her own work and so on. But I mean, first, yeah, the definition of this isn't just true for sexual assault, by the way, but like the kangaroo court process on college campuses is a real problem. It's something that almost every young friend or mentee I know is a little worried about. We also see this when it comes to allegations of any kind of racial harassment or fist fighting or something like that that might have a racial element. Yeah, the general policy is you're kicked off campus until there's some kind of sham hearing with a couple of administrators in it, and then you might be kicked off campus permanently. I don't know if our model in the Big Ten or the SEC is similar to what it is around the country, but I would really suspect that it is. And I'm not going to discuss like individual universities or like where this was, but like, I mean, I'm a tenured professor. I've been an academic executive, and like I've seen some of the procedures around campus sexual assault hearings. And this isn't necessarily all that rape is, but it's not a guy jumping out of the bushes with a knife. It's almost invariably two people that are drunk or on ecstasy that hook up totally consensually, usually pretty enthusiastically, until conflict occurs around some point. Like there's disagreement about what happened. And generally, there's a charge brought only against the guy, and the campus proceeding, which doesn't in any way resemble kind of the normal courtroom process, takes place. So, I mean, that is a genuine problem. Like, I would assume that the majority of claims have some basis in fact, but we don't really know. You generally have the word of two drunk people who liked each other well enough until point X of the night. None of it would pass muster in any court. I mean, I was trained as a lawyer before going into academia, so that's a real thing. Another point that I would make, just having listened to the like hell wouldn't be bad enough for my tormentor and all that stuff. I think in general, the modern upper middle class approach to trauma is really, really bad. It's incredibly bad. Like the number of people in their life, it's awful to say, but that have been sexually assaulted, perhaps a quarter, women, 10+% of men, a number of people that have been in a war, 5% of males, probably 2-3% of females. Just like, I mean, I've been in violent brawls involving large numbers of people. I've had people, you know, shoot at me, discharge weapons at me. I don't think sitting around, you know, Charles, that's right, Charles, you were from the same area, you know, they be popping. But I mean, like, if I were to sit around every day of my life and think, you know, my innocence could have been taken from me as a 16-year-old boy for wearing the wrong colors. There I was walking home. It was the wrong neighborhood. I still remember the scent of the, like, I don't think that's good. Obviously, if you're abused in this way, that's terrible. There probably should be criminal charges. It depends on what happened in the case. But to do that, to write 19,000 words or whatever about it, and then go through as part of your daily meditation 30 minutes of thinking about this and how guilty you feel. For anyone listening, that's the worst thing you can do with possible trauma. And I think we're making a lot of people, what would the term be? It's the opposite of anti-fragile, it's fragile. We're making a lot of people permanently inclined to suffer by doing this stuff. For guys, violence may be more on the physical side, but whatever kind you've experienced, alcoholic parent, like, don't spend your whole life dwelling on that. So two quick opinions.
No, I think that's great. And Larissa, to that, that's part of what you say, which is so important. You you kind of like do a great job of explaining both from the standpoint of the guy. Like you said, I don't know if he did. Maybe he's guilty. You didn't like take his side. If he's guilty, he should be punished. But there's a process that he should go through. We can't just assume that every time somebody says happy, we can't just, as you know, perfect as the Times say in the air quotes, believe all women. We can't just say that this is what you said, so this person's life is over. But yeah. What I assume you're saying is even the more important part, because the subtitle is that you're damaging, you're hurting women and you're hurting the victims, is that you're telling them the solution to a traumatic experience is to wallow in it, is to think about it all the time, put it in a tub, get in it with your candles and bathe in it. Like it's part of you. You are that rape. You are that physical attack. That's what you are. Never forget it. In fact, the woman was chastising herself. If ever she went a day without thinking about it, shame,
yeah, that was
on
the
you. Shame,
part.
Shame. Yeah. And it makes me think, you know, Will alluded to it kind of like the race. I got into it. I had to get off the phone, an hour long debate with a friend who was chastising me because of Fatima, Will, the guest we had on, who was talking about, you know, racism and how we deal with it every day. And it's so hard and whites are doing this. I'm like, is it benefit? It's not about arguing whether she's right or wrong. We can have our own views. What we were arguing is it, let's assume it's right. You know, Will like knows, laughs at me because I like to give people their argument. Sure. Let's assume it's true. All whites are bad. They have it out for black people and want to make it.
Seems iffy, but okay.
Right. But do we really, does it really benefit young black people to tell them that, you know, make them think there's no reason to try to work to get whatever they want because a white man's just going to slap your Legos over. They're going to kick over your sandcastle. Why even try? You know, there's no hope. It's all gone. Do you want to focus on that or focus on what they can control? So it's not really about the act, the truth of the accusation itself. It's how you're allowing people to deal with it. And it's kind of the same thing. They're telling you, your life is out. You're now a new person, right? You're now trauma. That is you. Yeah. And that's how you need to go through life. And is that how you read what she was saying and why you took issue with it?
Yeah. And that was kind of my experience too, was so completely about trying to not go down that road of being like a forever traumatized person. Like, I don't understand the appeal of that, actually. Like, that was that from the very beginning, I was like, I wanted, my attitude was, I lost, you know, I was raped by two men. I lost that time. Like, I had no control over my life or my body when that was happening. For the next, like, several hours, I had very little control as I was, like, in the hospital and the police. And then I was like, I want my life back now. Like, what do I need to do? And it is, you know, I think it is a unique violation, you know, like, to your point, Will, that, you know, people have suffered a lot of violence. And I do think rape is like kind of a unique violation. But regardless, what do I need to do to become, to get back from that? You know, and that was always my goal. And I didn't want to be, you know, an invalid or a child or someone who couldn't be trusted to like open up a book that might have a rape scene in it or go to a museum or something. I mean, if you're going to shut yourself off from those avenues, you're dead. Like, why would you? I would have walked over coals. Like, I was like, what do I need to do to get back? And I'm going to do it. And I did everything I could. And, so that's my experience. And like, I do feel a little bit like funny being like, because I don't want to be like, everybody should get over it right away. You know, people are going to do what they're going to do, but this is another option. And in this world, this fragile world that we have right now, in upper middle class and, kind of very Western, because I work with immigrants and they've all been through a lot of shit and manage, and I work with people, low income people, and but I it just it's become that, like, just this assumption that you will never get over anything. And I was told I would never get over it. I was told over and over again, you'll never get over this. And that's just seems that was unacceptable to me.
But and if they do suffer and they have a hard time getting over it, you feel for that person, and that's different. That's
Sure.
different if I tried to get over it and I
Yeah.
couldn't.
Yeah.
It could
Not that a
happen
lot
to
of
some people.
support. I had a ton of support, and there are a lot of factors in my case that made it unique. And I had justice, and I had a supportive boyfriend, and my father was supportive. I had all kinds of incredible support. So that's, I mean, if someone's not getting over it, that's something definitely to look at. Like, are people around them giving them the support they need? Because
Right.
I had every
Yeah.
single possible thing in my favor in the aftermath.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, because some people have a harder time getting over it, that's totally fine because it's an individual thing. But that's different from telling people that it's good to not get over it.
Yeah.
Almost putting people, and in a time where everything becomes partisan and political and all this kind of stuff, I think there's something deeper here. So I wonder your thoughts on why you think they want people to wallow in trauma.
Well, I think that actually the in this case of this writer, and I think this is pretty common, like, she's not the one who came up with this response, she's just kind of exemplified it really well. But if you don't have any, you didn't go to the police, because part of her article is like, you can't go to the police. There's no way you can go to the police. You'll just get raped all over again, which is what I thought also in my case, because that was one of the things the feminists had told me, everything I'd read, don't go to the police, and
If
so.
I could jump in there for a second, not at all, but like, really? The people were saying that if I would imagine that you would be told, and like I've given this advice, lawyers give this advice, but you might encounter an unsympathetic, gruff officer or something. But so people are actually saying things like you might be at more risk from the police, or there's a
No,
risk of sex. Oh.
more like sort of a psychological rape,
Oh.
you're gonna metaphysically or metaphorically
Right,
hit yourself
right. Oh.
again.
Because
It's
you're going to
totally
be
not,
traumatized all over
yeah,
again.
you'd be
You're going
traumatized.
to relive it.
Another,
And
and I heard
okay.
that even just recently, even just when the article came out, I heard over and over again, people were like, well, women can't go to the police because it's too traumatizing for them to go. And I'm like, what? Like, wait, so they were raped, and now just talking about it is too traumatizing? Like, are they going to talk about it with their therapist? Like, what, are they just never going to talk about it? And one of
And
the
no one should get come up, try to fight through that to get up
right.
the courage to try to get a violent person off the street.
It's the
Well, yeah, that
extreme.
too.
It's the extreme. Never blame the victim thing. Where and I don't at all want to cut off either one of you guys. But like, where the argument is, well, theoretically, there could be someone who's dealing with an emotional disability who would be really unable to do this, and we should consider this person. Did you guys see the DoorDash argument on social media?
No, I missed that one.
Okay, just a very, very quick synopsis. But some guy was like, I DoorDash all my meals every day, and it's necessary because of some random thing like long COVID. And everyone, including me, was like, no, you're just a lazy son of a bitch. Like, you're an upper middle class white kid in Chicago. This wasn't even a New Yorker, as far as the New Yorker sometimes it is. It was one of ours. And it was like, well, you could go downstairs. How about the local bodega? And so for a while, it was just like this. Like, no, you need to go to the gym. You treat your girlfriend better. Put on some clothes. Go to the store. There's a healthy, this is an able-bodied Caucasian male. And then people started saying, well, no, giving people this advice is very damaging because there could be people that are incapable of going to the store. And it was like, well, why would they be incapable of like using a microwave or something? Like, have your buddy go to the store. Well, some people have trouble microwaving. Like, it really just got insane. Like, therapists were jumping into the conversation. And my group of friends just ridicules this for good or ill. But there are a lot of people that take this extremely seriously, where the idea that telling anyone to do anything is a risk-filled business because somewhere in the world there could exist a person who's a perfectly nice person that would be unable to do that. Work? No, you don't understand what untreated neurodivergence. I mean, it's something you see quite a bit. So.
And why don't we go in the other direction? Because instead of just bringing everything down to the lowest common denominator, we could elevate the idea and be like, oh, well, here's somebody who actually was like has some disability and did figured it out, you know, and that's kind of cool. And let's use that as an example.
The one thing that I actually really respected about that conversation was that actual disabled people, like there's a disabled female war veteran in the thread, were like, no, this is complete bullshit. Like, I got my arm shot off in Fallujah, you know? And no, what I did was I went to the doctor. We have doctors in this country. I got one of those hooks. And as I got more money, I was able to get a replacement limb. And my husband's been great. And so there was this contrast between these people that were saying this, who had been terribly injured in wars and industrial accidents, and then people with names like Black Red Guard that were just saying like, no, you guys don't understand, it's not possible. All of them able-bodied white and black men, which is just really amazing. So it was one of those funny conversations.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I've had a recent conversation that ties into this too, which is like another factor to add on to this. What you have, because we've allowed what you two were talking about happen so long, and because the culture and society has changed to the point, you know, Larissa, I used to always joke that people's like, well, how do we get to this problem? They think it's political. And I was like, no, not it's cultural. And the best and I would jokingly say, well, you want to know where it all started? I blame Seinfeld. And they'd say, why? And I say, because you remember the episode where someone thought George and Jerry were gay? And they said, we're not gay. And then they did this and they said, not that there's anything wrong with it. Right. And from that day on, I jokingly say, people just started to say, well, you know, I know what's best for me, but who are we to say what someone else has been in? So I was in a conversation with someone about, you know, I do a lot, you know, we met talking about education, about what we should do, how can we fix the schools, how can we make, you know, curriculum better, how can we do this? And I was talking about parents, what we can do, and how we can help that connection. I'm trying to help the teachers, help the schools. It's not all their fault. The parents need to get a skin in the game. I said, maybe you send the kids home to do this assignment and work with this. And one of the people said, you know, something, said, I get what you're saying, Charles, and I agree with you, but that's not the reality on the ground. And I said, what do you mean? Well, you can't expect, usually you sometimes you have to assume the negative. What do you mean? You can't assume, for instance, that every kid has a parent at home. I'm like, in public school, really? Don't they kind of have to? They might not be a good one, but they got to have one. So,
Yeah.
but the point wasn't that she wasn't disagreeing with me. I thought she was, but she clarified. She wasn't disagreeing with me that that approach isn't the better approach. She was saying, as things are today, with the hand I'm dealt, as society and the culture is, and what the parents are used to, if you try to give any kind of gentle pushback, someone's going to come to you. Either some parent is going to get upset and say, you're saying I'm not a good parent. Or some administrator is going to come in and say, you can't treat those parents like that and act like they have to raise their own kid. But my point was, it's a problem that we got here and we have to do something to get out of it. We can't have a whole school district full of kids whose parents have no interest and no skin in the game in their kids' education.
And this is where I think the unsympathetic bro take comes in. Like, we've both generally been in reasonably powerful positions. I mean, you're on the school board. I think Larissa would agree with a lot of this as well. But I mean, like, to some extent, if someone's a crazy neurotic, you can just say, well, fuck you, you're nuts. And I think, like, in terms of some of the policies, I've looked at your record on the board, Charles. In terms of some of the policies that people are starting to push
You
forward now, I
mean you
think
read
they're.
the articles that have been going internet?
Yeah, I Googled you. It was interesting, man. I mean, like, the people that are criticizing you as like a white supremacist, and so it seems to be just batshit insane. But I mean, I think that's the thing. Like, if someone comes to a meeting and they're telling some local executive, like, you're a Nazi and the guy's black, and, you know, he's discussing feminism in the classroom or something, it's so far from reality that you can just ignore it. I mean, and I tend to talk a lot, so I'm going to shut up for a little bit to hear what you guys are saying, but like, just. This comes up over and over again where you find that there's a massive silent majority. Like, Charles, I think you're aware of my 9-inch penis women poll.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah,
Tell
it's more.
Larissa about the poll. Tell Larissa
I'm
about
aware
the
of
poll.
it. Sounds more interesting than it is. But no, like, I went on social media and I asked, and I actually had a link to a SurveyMonkey survey. This was reasonably well done. I'm pretty large in. And I just asked people, like, do you believe, this is a quote from GadSad, that some women have 9-inch penises? Like, that as a man, you can become a woman at will, whatever your characteristics are. And I have, as you might expect, kind of a male bro audience, but it also includes many people's partners who at least identify as sort of liberal or radical feminist, like 30% female. So I expected like 25%, yes, you can do that. And the actual results were 1.9%, yes. It was two.
Wow.
Dope. Yeah, no, we talked about this before, but it was just nobody actually thought that. And when you could go not just through the little survey, who knows how protected that is, but into the instrument and say what you really thought, it was the same for the men and the women. I mean, and I think that's true most of the time. Most people know you can walk downstairs to the fucking store and get a burrito. There's no group of people that can't. And if you had someone like that in your life, you would get them a burrito. I mean, it's really that's it.
But here's the key, Larissa. I'm not even as rough on them as Will. I am willing to say, some of you can't go get the burrito. You need help to go get the burrito. You look physically fine. You don't have any mental issues, physical issues, but you just can't go down the stairs. Maybe somebody should help you. All I'm saying is, do not write the rules for non-burrito boy. What we're saying, what we get in society today is, well, we can't write it. We had a policy that says on Tuesday, every person must go downstairs and get a burrito. Somebody would say, no, you can't have that policy because of Jim upstairs. No, let's have the policy. And if someone wants to help Jim, we help Jim. But don't be afraid to have a standard policy that meets what most people, reasonable people, should be doing.
That's correct.
No, the standard has become really, really low, and it's insane. Yeah, it's too much. I think getting back to why, like the trauma, like the sort of like never ending trauma, I in terms of rape and in terms of the article, I think that one of the issues is that if you don't have any, you never went to the police, you never did any kind of like formal, sort of declaration, then your only proof is your trauma. So, if 2 years later you're over it, then and people were kind of like, I'm not really sure if I believe that to begin with. Oh, look, you're over it now. So you have an investment, you have a reason to remain traumatized.
Wow.
So I think it's like
That's great.
really a negative, it's just a bad plan.
Is it? And now I don't want to get in trouble because this is not me saying this, people. This is me asking a question. Is it because at the time in the moment that in some of these cases they didn't think it was right?
I mean, you're gonna, it's my opinion. I don't know.
I mean, in your opinion, based on how they describe it.
Reconsider. I mean, there's definitely like really, really ambiguous cases. They're real cases, on campus. They're real, and there's real like horrible things that happen between people who know each other and care about each other, and or they so they thought. I mean, there's real cases, but there's also clearly ambiguous cases where, somebody changed their mind a couple days later. I mean, I've heard some of them.
There's also, to be blunt, and actually this is a little more common with males, but not much. Like, there's a big connection between like dark triad personality traits and histrionic public behavior. So I think we've all done, and yeah, we've all done the caveat. Like, of course, there are a huge number of real rape allegations. It's awful. But I mean, I think when you look at a lot of these very high profile cases where people have come forward and said, you need to understand my trauma. My trauma is not going to go away. This, it becomes a source of public writing. The mattress girl case may be the archetypal example, but they're really about 20. I mean, there was a Rolling Stone hoax or semi-hoax just a couple of weeks after that story started. I mean, quite a few of these, obviously not the majority of cases, but every one of these people had the sort of histrionic public narrative. This is part of who I am. This changed my identity. And what happened was not something that most normal people would have defined as rape or abuse. So, I mean, my definition, I'll let just like a follow-up that might seem unrelated. There's a famous study of people with quote unquote long COVID that found that 65% of them had never had COVID. So I think you can have two problems at once. Like, there are actual abusers in society. There are also people that experience just the normal things in life, like what's his name, that comedian's bad date, and go on to make these the center of really high profile stories. And those two groups of people probably don't overlap very much. That's what I found with hate crime hoaxes. Like, the hoaxers were performative theater kids, but there were lots of white and black guys beating the crap out of each other. Those are just treated as misdemeanor cases in some city.
Right. No, that's true. Larissa, I want your thoughts on connecting to what Will said on the Kavanaugh case, because the Kavanaugh case was interesting for me for two reasons. One, it was the first time that a bunch of, as Will called them, the bros who stayed out of this stuff and didn't really care, kind of stood up and took notice and say, well, wait a minute, especially if they were like in their 40s, they were like, man, I did a lot of crazy stuff. I'm not saying I raped anybody, but did some crazy stuff in school. And if somebody could just come back and say, in 1984, you did X, how do I defend myself? You can't prove a negative. There were no social media or cell phones. I can't say, track my phone, right? So, there was that a little bit of uneasiness, but I don't know how much you two remember of the case itself. And I could, I didn't follow it enough that I cared about every part. But what seemed, if I recall it correctly, what she accused, and this may be what you're talking about, both Will and Larissa, in the sense that what she claimed happened, believing that is true, at the time, go to the police, do all the right things. I'm not even sure, forget about misdemeanor. I'm not sure much would have happened to him. Now, granted, we can say because the times were different, but you two can correct me if I'm wrong. But if I recall, what she said was they were all at a party and they were in the room where you throw all the coats. And he tried to kiss her, forcibly hold her down, and she got out. So there'd be no DNA. There was no actual rape, rape, as you say in the article, the old-fashioned kind. So if the police had been called right at that moment, most reasonable people would say nothing would have happened. So the fact that that's her accusation, and it's 30 plus years later, the fact that it got so much coverage and so many people said automatically believe her. I'm like, I do believe her, but he didn't say she never claimed him a rape. That got lost immediately. And he became a rapist. And then it was group, what do you call it? It was like gang rape and multiple times. And they were having rape parties and people were going to him. And then the other girl said, and I know they did it because I went to several. And so your common sense said, you went to several rape parties on your own, just voluntarily? You just showed up at six rape parties as a girl?
I mean, I think Larissa's gonna handle the full question first, but I actually remembered that case. And yeah, the things they started saying just became completely insane. Like one of them was that Kavanaugh was getting in fights on boats. Like he was attacking people's wives and like the local port. Yeah, there were supposed to be parties where there were like lines of guys outside rooms with high school girls in them and so on. And there'd been no evidence of that ever in that community, which is just a kind of middle to upper middle class regular town. So, I mean, yeah, it got really, really political and started involving some people that seemed pretty crazy on both sides of the fence really quickly.
But 30 years later, so what are your thoughts on that? Both the timing and the fact that what was originally alleged when this all started was, not something that would have been, a major crime in 1984 or whatever it was.
I'm like just right now thinking that I kind of had something like that happen to me in ninth grade. Like that I'm like just now like, oh
You
yeah,
should write an article
this
for
I should
Libertine
track
or
that
whatever
guy
it was.
down and see what he's and it was obnoxious and horrible and like, it was like a senior guy and I was in ninth grade and he kind of like pushed me down and like and it was humiliating and I was mad. But yeah, I'm like so Gen X because I'm like I just like shrugged it
He's
off.
such a jerk,
Like
right?
there should be something. I mean, this stuff is obnoxious. Like I feel like there should be something. Like you should get a ticket or something, maybe. Like for something like,
Have to stand up in public and renounce their bad behavior and
yeah. I
something
mean,
like that.
you get a ticket for like, I don't know where harassment starts that you can get like a misdemeanor or something. But I mean, I do feel like there should be a little more graded.
Right.
There are things that happen that are ambiguous that are not good.
Right, that you shouldn't be doing, right.
Yeah, and that the women don't want to go to the police because they're like, I'm not gonna, it's not worthy of going to the police, but it was bad and I'm mad about it. And he should know that that was wrong to do that. So like, what do you do about those cases? I feel like there should be something else in the middle to do.
I think the typical solution was that you'd slap him or your brother would punch him. I mean, where that's
Get
resolved
somebody to
in
get
time.
old school, get somebody to kick his ass. Right.
But
You
that's
call
exactly
you.
right. Like, it's resolved in the arena of normal human interactions. So, like, with the Kavanaugh thing, there seemed to be two questions. Like, what was the incident? And then how do we handle that after many, many years?
Yeah.
First of all, I think most people have experienced something that could be considered technical sexual assault. Like, I wouldn't equate this as a man to women's experiences, but I remember at one of my parties, someone, let's say, touched themselves intimately, rubbed their fingers on my lips, and then kissed me. And it was just like, it was like a raver thing. I thought it was a little gross, and I was like, get the hell out of here. And that was it. Now, I'm sure that's some technical crime because it involves, the private parts, but it would be like what you said, it would be a charge for like a misdemeanor assault, where the maximum penalty is like 30 days in county jail, if you actually look at that. I don't honestly think the Kavanaugh situation was even that serious. The allegation was that Kavanaugh, like this like 16-year-old Brett Kavanaugh, He's like a junior, was at a party, and a girl agreed to go upstairs with him to like the coat room. Like these were kids' tits. And he tried to kiss her. She didn't want to kiss more than once. So he tried like holding her shoulders. She started yelling at him. His buddy comes in. He may or may not have been with the girl himself. His buddy's like, don't be a jackass, grabs him, and they start wrestling. That's pretty much the description of the incident. I'm sure all these people were wasted from that description of like, and then they began wrestling kind of. So in that situation, I guess you could call the police. I would probably encourage a daughter to do something like that. The guy's just humiliated. He has to go down to the station. What are you, a rapist?
That'll teach
But I
him a
mean,
lesson.
hey, you Chester, you know, but like, there's no real felony criminal penalty you can bring there. I think that's point one. That would be true for either sex. Someone grabs you by the penis or the ass. I mean, depending on which one you are. The other thing, though, that I think is more important is how do you handle that 40 years later? So, like, if I had done something like that in high school and I'd gotten in a fight with a girl's brother and I got my ass kicked, you know, you feel embarrassed about it. But, and I don't think I've never done such a thing, but I don't think like that you just charge that to the game and move on. The question is, if someone 30 years later came forward and said, in high school, I made out a lot with my boyfriend. I usually enjoyed it, but I don't think there was initial consent for everything we did, and breaks down like 10 or 12 explicit things from well before any statute of limitations. The question, honestly, is should society do anything? Should you just assume this is true? Should you try to punish someone decades later? What if he comes back at her and you get the sort of stuff that slithers out of divorce hearings? So there are real questions there, I'd say, legally.
Right.
Yeah, and they're really kind of pertinent because there is so much sexual freedom, you know, and like starting 30 years ago, really, you know, like in the 70s, and so that's the stuff that's coming up. But you know, there's just so much sexual freedom. So how do you regulate it? And so much of it is happening between inexperienced young people. And I mean, I don't know. Sex has been regulated forever. Like every society does something to regulate sex, and now we've just taken everything away. You know, we don't have chaperones, we don't have hijabs, we don't have curfews, you know, and so how, we don't have marriage, you know, at age 19. So what are you going to do? Like
A
and so there's
contract. We're gonna have a
this, right.
contract.
Well, they have the consent rules, the consent things, which is totally would be nice guideline. Like the consent rule seems like a very nice guideline, you know, but it's actually there's all this stuff riding on it. So these kids can get in so much trouble if they didn't ask for
And
consent all
those
the way
forms are so sexy too. You really
through.
want to have sex after you fill all that stuff out.
The other thing, Charles, like this gets into the rise of kind of the hijabi feminist, which is actually a great phrase that I might steal. But I mean, where people are saying, most whenever I spar with feminist casual friends online, what it strikes me that they want, I actually said this in a debate with just a conversation with, I think, Anna Slatz the other day. What it strikes me that they want is traditional right-wing gentlemen. So you get all of these questions like, why don't you guys open doors anymore? Can't you at least wait a few dates? And I'm like, I mean, I guess I could at this point. Like I'm a conservative. But I mean, it's very much an attempt to return to pretty much the rules we used to have, just under different names. So like the consent contracts in college aren't actually a joke. Like, I actually pulled up the ideal consent policy for let's say a small state university in the state of Kentucky. And it is, consent should be explicit, enthusiastic, totally sober, and preferably provable. And that sounds great, but it would invalidate probably 95% of actual contact in, say, marriages. If my partner comes home and says something like, you want to do me today? And I've worked for 10 hours, and I'm sure, yeah. I mean, you're not giving explicitly enthusiastic written consent. It's not a thing that happens, that everyone in a relationship knows that. So what you're doing is taking these people that haven't had the time to build normal relationships and creating an infrastructure that's so uncomfortable that they might have to get back to some kind of simulacrum of what used to be there. I mean, like what I just said is funny, but this is an actual policy. Like you can be, I presume, expelled if you violate this policy.
Yeah.
Preferably provable.
That's
You're
insane.
supposed to film everything. I mean, it's an interesting situation.
And the other thing that annoys me about consent is that it's all about yes. It's never about no. So they like no one can say no. Like, and they don't tell the you know the college students, like according to my daughter who's in college, you know, it's all about consent, but there's no like for A, you can opt out of hookup culture. Like that's completely fine and it's up to you. And B, you could say no. And how about if you could say no loudly? You know, you could, like, I just don't understand why that's not even why there's all this freedom, but like the idea that you could expect young women or men to say no, it's all just about yes. You have to say yes. You have to
Right.
just, it's very demure, you know,
That's
you're supposed to.
actually a really interesting, the phrase that comes to mind is actual female point, that there are these lengthy books of what to do. I mean, I've read Our Code, like what to do in different sexual interactions and so on. So, I mean, yeah, the default option is presented as yes. Actually, that's really interesting. And
You
that
can
like,
be
if he
like pushed
asked,
in. Just because someone says yes doesn't mean that they really mean yes. You know, there are a lot of people who say yes to things that they don't want to say yes to. So
right.
it's already like just in itself.
That's the question of like, are 18-year-old people really consenting to? But I mean, like, so the default presentation would be, remember, if he asks for anal, don't do it unless she says yes. I mean, the response of, well, I could just say no to that for the first pretty long period of time is not emphasized. I agree with that.
Right. So I gotta ask then, Larissa, I know why you thought that that piece needed to be rebutted, but what made you decide to go as far as writing the details of your experience in Italy? Is it because you think that that needed to be pointed out to bring some clarity to how you are contrasting their approach to trauma?
For anyone who hasn't read the article, it's, you know, it starts with a critique of the article we've been talking about.
Tormented,
Yeah,
right?
the tormented article. And then it's about sort of the sweeping new definition of rape that's been happening like since the 90s, like when I was in college, it started happening. And then it's like, and then it's my story. So my story is that I was living in Italy and I walked home from a movie by myself because I'd missed the bus very late. And my boyfriend was working and I was accosted by two men as I was passing a park and pulled into the park, like really just like sort of the classic stranger assault. And I fought back really hard and consequently got beat up really badly because I kept resisting and but it was two guys and one of me, which is totally not fair. And so I lost and I was raped by both of them. And then they took my jewelry, my money, and they left. And I went home and called my boyfriend and he came and after he kind of cleaned my face because I was super fucked up, said we have to go to the police. And I was like, oh, I can't go to the police because I'm a feminist and you don't understand about the patriarchy and you know it's never nothing will good will come of it. It'll all be traumatic. And he insisted, as I said in the article, he didn't know about the patriarchy. So because he's an Italian guy.
Italian guy, what's that?
And he was amazing and like lovely and so we went to the police and meanwhile my assailants had gotten into a car accident and they ended up being brought to the same hospital where I was.
Which was crazy, right?
And they were wheeled right past me and the hospital was a mess like that, you know, I was like examined by this massive team of male doctors and like I had to undress like in sort of a public room and not like I had my shirt on, but I had to like take my pants off and they were all like help all these men were like helping me, you know. So I mean, A, it's a really good story, you know, like it's a very like intense and like detailed and colorful story. And it just seemed like and my editor was really, really pushing me to not pushing me, but like inviting me, being like, take as much time and space as you want, you know, tell this whole story journalistically. So that was part of it. And I also I don't I mean the idea that I wouldn't tell it is kind of connected to the idea that it's something I should keep secret. And I've never felt that. I always from the first day I was like, this is okay, so I need to like understand that this was not my like I didn't do anything shameful. The shameful thing is to rape.
Right.
So I didn't do anything shameful. And so I was always like kind of comparing it to a car accident, like keeping the standard of like you know, I'm not going to take like I don't live in a purity culture. I don't live in a modesty culture. Like my economic value has not been diminished by the fact that I was raped, which it is in some cultures still to this day. I mean, that's kind of it's like the horrible thing is A, the rape, and B, that the thing the rest of your life is ruined. You know, you can never get married, you can never have kids. You're ruined, you're exiled, or you have to marry your rapist, or you have to be killed, or whatever. So yeah, it just seems like I should tell the story, and I'm also proud of it. You know, I'm proud of myself for, you know, I look back as like I was 23 years old and I think I took the assault itself, like the fact that I fought back, I'm really proud of, and the fact that I it was really hard. The whole thing sucked and was like devastating, but I'm proud of it, and I think that I think there are other women who are, I'm not the only person who feels that way, by the way. Like I have heard from other women, and I've read about other women who feel they feel stronger. You went through this trial, this like ancient battlefield, like that's this battlefield has been around forever. And it irritates me a little bit that there's no heroes off of that battlefield.
Right.
There's so many women who've gone through that, and you're supposed to like keep it secret when meanwhile, like you were given this like ultimate test, and one way or the other, you survived it. And
Right.
so I'm proud of how I responded to that. And I think it made the piece better, just to, it was like a contrast to the other piece, which was so murky and kind of coy and hid everything. Like, why?
Well, that's an interesting thing too. So what was the response? Because basically, you're challenging what a lot of the hardcore feminists, not all today, because some people are pushing back for it, but a lot of them are saying, which, people don't like to be challenged, so that's part. And then from their standpoint, you did everything wrong. You wrote your story, you said you weren't a victim. They would say that you kind of blamed the victim because you were like, in hindsight, I thought about it. I was like, was that the best decision? Could I? I'm not saying that it was 100% those guys' fault, but should I have walked home by myself? You were open to saying that. You went to the police. You're not supposed to do that. All of these things down the line, every step of the way through that article was everything that they go against. So what was the response? Did you get a lot of response from them saying anything, or was most did they just not say anything?
Yeah, I thought I was really going to get dragged. And I saw, I'm from a very liberal, not even liberal, I'm from a leftist background, like progressive. And most of my friends and family are very progressive. So I actually saw my family like a couple of weeks before for my dad's birthday. And I was like, I have to tell you guys something. I was like, Quillette, some people call it right adjacent, like, and I might be called right adjacent, and I had to like prepare them. And, they and I would run into friends who are feminists, and I'd be like, oh, you're not gonna like it, I don't think. So I didn't get dragged by anyone, which I've been joking. I guess you're golden, like you're
Oh, that's
untouchable.
good.
If you tell a story like that, nobody can touch you. But I but my
Yeah,
and
it
we have a lot of
seems pretty awkward for someone to act offended that this happened to you, like that crazy woman. Like, I don't know. I don't know.
yeah,
So.
they I just they didn't no one went after me. And of my a lot my, most people were silent. Like I have a lot of feminist friends who I put it
Okay.
up on Facebook, which is like I don't really I just put up pictures of my kids and pets and stuff on Facebook, and I have relatives and neighbors and stuff, and old friends from Brooklyn, because I used to live in Brooklyn, old like feminist friends, and they didn't say anything.
Oh, they just stayed out of it. Yeah. Because I didn't think they'd go that far, Will, but I thought they'd say something like pull her aside and say, don't you think that this is enabling the race business? Kind of like what Fatima said about your book and your stats saying, well, don't you think you're encouraging people to not say anything about hate crimes by saying some of them are hoaxes? No, I'm telling the truth that some of them were hoaxes, right?
Yeah, I think there are two levels. Like, one, it would be incredibly difficult to criticize someone who told that story by saying something like, no, if it's like that bitch isn't a real feminist, like what? You would put yourself as you'd be absolutely the villain in that story. I mean, that's crazy. But I mean, also too, something that has to be recognized, and I think progressives are worse about this even than hard right conservatives, is that there obviously are points on both sides, which is why there are two major, fairly successful political parties. Like the right is correct on guns, the left is correct on healthcare. I mean, you can disagree with me on either one of those, but these are major ongoing debates. So if you're saying something like, don't go to the police because they will psychologically, if not physically, rape you again if you've been sexually assaulted, that's insane. I mean, that's not a correct thing. If anything, a logical feminist movement would be pressuring the police to look through all the backlog kits, use this crazy DNA technology we have now, all that, and
That is
find them.
where the energy should be going. And if you go onto rape activist sites, and one of the first things they say, and everyone talks about this, is how rape is the most underreported crime. And I'm like, who could change that?
Not
Guess
only the rape, only the
how?
person who were raped, yeah.
Yeah. And if it's so terrible, and I know there are terrible stories of women who go to the police and they're treated horribly, but it's like, so that should be where the focus is like making it so that you have someone to go with you. Like make that should be the focus. Let's get all the rapes reported.
Right. Yeah. You don't not report it. You fix
This is
the
one of those
system.
things when you talk about rape activist sites or prison abolitionist sites. Like, I actually, one of my goals as a leader would be to solve problems, not to make a lot of histrionic public statements. But I mean, I'll sometimes get pretty cynical debating these people because they don't seem to have a core philosophy that would work on any level. So, I mean, if most of the people I've talked to who would define themselves as anti-prison activists, or for that matter, anti-rape activists, don't want there to be a justice system at all, as far as I can tell. So you get into this weird question of, okay, you're talking about this terrible crime. You're saying it's underreported. Believe it or not, I'm an ally. How do we work to stop this? Well, we work to stop it by getting rid of the police and courts. Like, it just seems to be kind of a child's fantasy that's been allowed to go on. I think because, like, so much of this other stuff on kind of the sensitive left, no one wants to abusively criticize it. No one wants to talk to a rape victim about how their ideas about policing are insanity. Yeah, see, Charles has his hands up. Like, hell no, I'm not the one. But I mean, at some point, if you want there to be fewer rapes, there are really practical things you can do. Like, from a legal background, that backlog kits issue would lock up tens of thousands of guilty offenders. So you have to, who's going to look through the kit? So it has to be a cop. It has to be a police detective. I mean.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like they're looking for solutions. And that was kind of, you know, that's the modern response, the modern feminist response. It does not seem like it's looking for solutions. Even just the fact that you can't say no, like no is not like a part of the thing that they're kind of advocating that young women learn how to say.
If I can ask just a feminist guest that's given a lot of on point answers here, that seems to be a weird duality in modern feminism in general. The question of how to interact with men or with a society that has both men and women in it. And I personally find it extremely bizarre to see feminists endorsing, say, triple X porn or prostitution should be legalized. Like, I mean, I don't really care. It's a minor vice for a lot of people, but that is not what I would think of as the most rad femmy perspective you can come with. So there's this weird dichotomy between I am me, it's my body, I do exactly what I want. I don't have to say no if I don't want to. I don't have to go to the cops if I don't want to. And the obvious reality that in a society that's 50% male and somewhat unfair, all those things are going to produce disastrous outcomes that seem obviously predictable to a little kid. So any thoughts? Like, how can that be fixed?
I don't know. Well, Louise Perry just wrote a piece about Andrea Dworkin. I don't know if for the Free Press. I don't know if I don't personally want to go all the way over to Andrea Dworkin level of, you know, banning porn. And I don't know.
I don't care about porn one way or another. I think adults like sex. But I mean, I think that, again, there seems to be, like, you would expect the people backing actual porn education for people, not like watching it, but like, this is bullshit. Know that, kid. The people educating women about their actual options, like, you can say no, you would expect that if feminism is going to have a major social role, that would be it. Like, I mean, when you read women's magazines headlines, like Cosmo a couple months ago is like, do everything he wants. That's a direct quote. Like, as a guy, you know, you're not entirely upset by that idea, but it's weird to see a feminist writing that. I guess that's the point.
They gotta
get Cosmo's, in the ring, put their dukes up.
Yeah, well, Cosmo's always been, I mean, Helen Gurley Brown used to talk like affectionately about how on Fridays they would wear their pretty underwear because that was the day the men chased them around the office and tried to steal their underwear, you know, in the 60s. So Cosmo has always, like, Cosmo is a whole separate thing. But a really big turning point for me was when Teen Vogue, maybe like 20
example, yeah.
Teen Vogue for teenagers, presumably, had an article about anal sex. And you know, very positive, like, oh, this is how to have anal sex, you know, isn't that great? And it's like, teenage girls, I'm sorry, that was just like appalling to me that they're pushing anal sex to
as,
teenage
as girls. I recall, that article actually had the line in it, so he wants it in the ass. And again, there's the element of just dark humor to this, where, like, men and women have sparred in a loving but mutually skillful fashion for thousands of years. I enjoy riposte from both sides. You don't expect the feminists to be the ones writing, so he wants it in the ass. I mean, it's the Ouroboros has gone so far that the challenge has disappeared and the crazy solutions are being proposed over here.
Yourself three times. I think that
we got to save him. Ultimate male role.
To one kind of final quick question on this topic. I mean, people should go read the article. It was great, well written. It's really informative. But it made me think. In this conversation, you talked about the very you're from a very liberal family, progressive, and some of your views. But you're kind of challenging the feminist approach. You're openly saying in the article that what they're pushing for is harming women. And then, the next time you come back, I guess we'll talk about education. You talked about how in that you started to kind of evolve and notice that how a lot of things that felt good and sound good weren't really helping, and that you kind of come to a revelation about some of those things. So Will's question was more like, why do the left do this? Why are feminists doing this thing that seems that is at odds with what they believe? So I'll bring it down more locally and say, for you, as you've had a transformation, somewhat not really politically, probably, you probably are the same person you were before. You're just seeing a more pragmatic, a kind of view on how things would work. How has that change been for you? How do you notice going from being very progressive to now writing for, slightly right-wing publication?
Center
So,
left.
right, center
Yeah.
left,
Where
but
the real Nazis are.
right, center left, which is MAGA to the left. So, what's that been like? And was it like, did you just wake up one day and say, wow, why am I different from everyone else? Or was the progression slow?
It was going on for a long time. I moved upstate. I used to live in Brooklyn, and I moved upstate in 2010, and I had neighbors who had Tea Party signs on their lawns and and giant Trump signs later, like giant Trump signs and fuck Biden signs and
Yeah, like crazy big, by the way. It blew me away when I went to Long Island. I'm like, oh my God, did I leave the state? I
yeah,
mean, they're
but
like big. They're like the size of a house.
they've got
Oh
huge
yeah.
signs. Yeah, but
You
and
guys
then
should
I
come to
found out.
Kentucky. It's like the sides of barns and like
Yeah.
flags with Trump on them that are as big as the American flag, and they're both on a
Yeah.
50-foot flagpole painted
Right.
red, white, and blue. This is God's country, right here.
Yeah, we have it just almost that level. But and then I turned out I really liked all my neighbors. They were really nice and they were great neighbors. And so that was a big kind of turning point to begin with. And they also didn't care about what I was. They kind of accepted me. I would be like, I'm a Democrat, and then everything just went, to Trump derangement syndrome. Like I don't like Trump, but people just went crazy, I think. And then one, like we were talking about, like education, like I started realizing that like progressive education wasn't serving a lot of people. It's
My
serving.
favorite line you said was about the test. I was very anti-test. Then I realized, what do you mean? That's the only way you can help people.
Yeah, because I work with adults. They need to pass the GED. They need to pass the test to get into college. Yeah, so that all happened. And then once one thing falls, then everything kind of falls. And yeah. So
So
it's alienating because I have every gender ideology made me crazy. Like now the Cass report just came out and it seems like things are kind of turning. But like I cannot believe that questioning whether these really extreme measures, surgical and hormonal measures on teenagers, just questioning it had people yelling at me. Like that was mind-boggling to me. Like it still is just shocking to me that you're saying like I don't know if 13-year-olds should have puberty blockers,
right.
or I don't know if like children should be changing their, socially changing their sex, like trying to like, and that people would yell at me like
Oh
that.
yeah.
Just like I still cannot like, because you should question. You're not even going to question it,
Right, right. Well, that's what Will alluded to at the beginning was about the school board. Is if you go look it up, we made the cover of the New York Times last week because we said, do
useful if you own
transgender
birds.
girls have a physical advantage over biological girls? Just a question. Do they? And then we were transphobic. Elliot Page came to our school board meeting.
Elliot, oh, Ellen Page, yeah, okay.
You can't say.
Whatever.
Yeah, but showed up at the school board meeting in
He can come
solidarity.
challenge me.
Yeah, to in solidarity to fight against the transphobia that was. Does a transgendered girl in high school sports have an unfair advantage? Maybe we could check. Maybe we should find
Maybe
out.
we should find
You
out,
guys in New York just have a team with like a 6'2" black dude and a 6'3" Caucasian guy that like swept through the girls' championships. I'm pretty sure that was New York, right?
Oh, I didn't see that. It's
And
possible. I don't know.
they had a whoever whatever state it was might have been Jersey, but they had two Hosses in the middle. They
And
had
they
two
did
guys
well,
that
right?
started for the varsity team from high school. Yeah,
And they
I'm
did
like,
well.
what's up?
I said, and they did well, right?
Yeah, because they were 6'3"
No,
males. Yeah, they were killing it, man. They were dunking the ball. I mean, it's so just a
hey,
brief
Dawn
comment.
Staley said girls dunk.
There actually are some. I mean, like, there are people in the
Yeah, but they
WNBA
dunk
now,
like
like
one every
Candace Parker,
19
that are.
games. There's 19 dunks in every game in men's sports.
Yeah, but I mean, like, there are WNBA players that could play some men's college ball. Like, Parker's good, but this is a different side conversation about the skills quotient of the WNBA. Like, whatever. But I think that this gets into one question that Larissa just kind of batted back and forth with us, which is why, when you're talking about like the feminist teenager magazine running articles on how to anally please your boyfriend, how did that happen? And I think it's because you're getting into a religious philosophy. I'm not going to do like full James Lindsay mode here, but the idea seems to be it's basically just what Nietzsche mocked as prey morality times five. The idea is that the most damaged, most harmed, most useless person in the room is always right. So if a gay teenager tells you that they want to see this perspective on sexuality, you don't say, shut up, kid, wait 5 years. You immediately go along with them. If a badly damaged former actress, actor if you prefer, shows up and says that the professional school board members don't know what they're doing, you listen to that person, so on down the line. I'm kind of rambling here, but I think the trans woman thing was the ultimate example of this because it's just purely the Shahada, right? Like there are no gods but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. You can't unsay it once you say it. Like nobody actually believes that. But because the people who'd been temporarily elevated to the top of the progressive stack, thinking back to Occupy meetings, were these autogynephilic males generally who are saying that they were the most vulnerable form of women, no one could disagree with them. And so whether or not they were saying nonsense, you have to agree with the most vulnerable person, like the Christian concept of the lamb. And that's how you get so much crazy shit, because most people are failures and lunatics because they don't actually have that much to say. I follow an older, crueler way as it happens. So if you just listen to these people, you wind up with the anal sex feminists and the open locker rooms and Planet Fitness and so on. And I mean, it's funny, but it's also deeply troubling if you have any interest in the future of men, women, sports, so on, as I suppose I actually do. So, problem.
Will is in rare form tonight, but do you want to follow up,
Sound like this all the time, right? I'm just
follow
making
that
jokes.
up? Thing about women's sports, because the women's sports thing is really horrible, I think, because to be a girl and to go through adolescence and teen years and to become like an elite athlete or even just a college athlete, it's you're going through different things than boys who are athletes go through. I mean, boys are it's pretty heroic thing to do. You know, girls like boys who are good at sports. You know, the boy who's good at sports, it's you know that's a flex for girls. You know, the girl who's good at sports maybe, but not necessarily. You know, she's not necessarily going to become like more like a higher in the sort of sexual marketplace. You know, because she's really good at soccer or basketball, she might be, but it's not a given. And so I really feel like girls, it's a special challenge that they go through to become these elite athletes, and then to have to be competing with men. I don't know. I think it's really disgusting, actually. I think it's shameful.
Yeah, well, I guess that we've already done an hour. We have to leave it there.
I
Larissa,
want
will
to
you
say one
come?
more thing.
Oh, okay, go
Yeah,
ahead.
I just wanted to say I'm so glad that you guys invited me on here because, as I was telling you, Charles, that on when the article went viral, it was retweeted almost exclusively by high profile women. You know, the high profile people who retweeted it were
Oh,
women,
no, men, though.
and no men. Like, and they were scared, and we were hearing that they we were hearing praise like off Twitter, you know, on listservs, and you know, and personally, like at Quillette, they were hearing from like pretty high profile men that they really liked it, but they were too, you know, I guess they were afraid of being me too'd or whatever. Like, it just seems it's somehow it has become that rape is just a women's issue, and like, okay, I get it, like, because it's mostly happening to women, but you know, even if you're going to go with the 1 in 4 statistic, which is, you know, not like a great statistic, but all the women who are being raped are wives, girlfriends, daughters,
Siblings.
sisters of men, you know, so it's not just a woman's issue. And I feel like, you know, when men were handling it, or in places where men do handle all the rape, the prosecution of rape and the prevention of rape is really bad. Like, just men handling it is bad. But now we have like, it's become like very female the way it's being handled, and it's bad too. It's like clubhouse politics, you know, and we need a mix, you know. It's like I don't know. I just think the alliance is like really essential. I totally, like I said, you know, the fact that my boyfriend kind of like was helping me through that immediate aftermath was so essential. And there is like a real place for men to be heroic and essential in, you know, dealing with the aftermath of rape and the prevention of rape.
Well, I was going to end, but since you say that, I thought about it earlier and forgot you brought it up again. I'm sure if you do a lot of interviews, most people don't ask this question, so I should. You say he was so great at that time. I'm assuming he's not your husband. So, have you ever connected with him? Did you ever talk to him? Did you ever follow up and say, "Yeah, thanks for helping me out,
You
Mr.
know,
Italian man"?
he got in Italy, you have to do military service, like required military service. So
Right.
he, like a month after the rape, he got called to military service. So he,
Ah.
and it was, and so we kind of like had a long distance thing, and then I broke up with him because I was just like, this is too complicated, and
Right.
I'm dealing
Right.
with all this stuff. And then we wrote a couple times, and then I did for years. I didn't hear from him, and in the course of researching the article, because we were vetting everything, like everything had to be vetted. I finally found him on Facebook. I went like way deep into Facebook and found him, and I reached out to him. But he's, you know, he's not really on Facebook, I don't think, so he hasn't responded. Like
So he didn't respond.
he's not
Oh,
too
I thought
active.
you were gonna finally get a response, but you
Yeah,
know,
no.
I just had to ask that because you said at that moment he was he did what he was supposed to do at a time when men tended not to do that, and that's a good thing. We wanted to credit him, and hopefully after this, when we tweet it out and we post it, we'll send it to some people, and hopefully some men will start reading the article and
Yeah.
commenting.
Well, I really
But I,
appreciate you guys having me on to talk about it, because
no
it's
problem at all, and I do hope you
not
come back. Because the education piece is important too, and you have some very interesting things to talk about. Literacy. She is Larissa Phillips, the founder and director of the Volunteer Literacy Project. Larissa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Country to stay. God bless the US of A. Land of the free and a home of the brave. God get all of the praise. I got a country to stay, 'cause I'm Patriot J and I'm saving a day.